Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Welcome to Cockpit to Cowl, the show that explores general aviation safety topics from the combined perspective of flight instructors, pilots, and mechanics, exploring both pilot and aircraft topics to make aviation safer and more enjoyable. I'm Jeff Simon, pilot, AMP/IA, and president of Social Flight.
I'm Brian Schiff, ATP, CFI, been teaching over 40 years. I would not fly anything that I worked on.
Well, I got to tell you, this, oh my goodness, is this the highlight of my week to be able to spend this time with you, Brian, and doing this. I always say that. I tell you, it's so true. I love doing this show and getting to hear this. So post your questions, everyone, as we kind of go along here, and we'll do our best to get to it. But tonight's topic is fuel mysteries and management. And there's a lot going on in this world, and I want to talk about it from the perspective of flying, from the perspective of maintenance. So let's kick in it from a perspective of flying first. And Brian, I want to ask you, what are some of the fuel related things that you teach both your initial and then also, you know, your recurrent, your IFR, all these other more experienced students? What first comes to mind for you?
Safety and being conservative, ultra conservative, is the foremost thing. It amazes me. I just want to say initially, I'm thinking about what, as you're speaking there, that people, we're talking about fuel. It's this fluid that we put into our tanks. It's energy that we turn into speed and altitude. It's just kind of amazing to me that we can take this fluid. That's probably why it's so expensive, because of that kind of magic that it does. But we are super reliant on it. That is the energy that we rely on. So I think it's very important to take it seriously, to manage the maintenance of the tanks, the airplane, and all the systems where the fuel runs, that whole pipeline to the engine, to how it burns. And then on the piloting aspect, I think, as I said, conservative. Be as conservative as you can be. If I need 2 hours of fuel extra, I want to have 4 hours of fuel extra. They say there's nothing more worthless than the altitude above you, the runway behind you, or the fuel that's not in your tank, or I should say a tank with too much air in it. That's always a bad thing. And I see so many pilots, and I'm almost to the point of anger about how someone can run out of fuel. It's a philosophy and a mindset that we just need to get through to pilots. And when I train, I don't care if that airplane came back from a 30-minute flight training, and then we're going to take it out, we're going to top it off. It's just a mindset. I want to leave with a fixed amount of fuel every time. You know, people see what happens at the airlines, and then they take that back to general aviation. They say, they go through a professional career track, they go to the airlines, they see that the airlines will take what they need plus the reserve and not top off. There's a different reason for that. A much different reason is the cost of carrying that fuel. And it makes a huge difference. Plus, we have ultra-conservative reserves. In little airplanes, it is just not going to cost you a whole lot more to carry. I know what everybody's thinking. I hear it. Weight and balance. I don't want the extra weight. Well, most of the time, 10 more gallons or 70 more pounds or 60 more pounds is not going to make a big difference as far as your weight and balance, but could make, you know, an hour of fuel. It's huge. So I don't like seeing people plan for what they need plus 45 minutes of reserve. 45 is just not enough if something goes wrong, if the winds aren't as planned. I don't know about you, but have you ever seen the winds maybe a little bit different than what they were forecast? So you want to plan for these contingencies, and I basically consider that I want to have as much stacked in my favor as I can. If I can top off, I do it. If it's a weight and balance issue, I'm going to take it down to as much, still down to max gross takeoff or the highest weight I want to be. But if I can't get to destination with adequate conservative reserves, then I'm by no means am I even going to stop to hesitate to think I'm going to stop and make a potty break so I can, you know, gas up some more. Yeah. Plan the stops accordingly. Don't try to stretch it out.
Right.
And then I could keep going forever. There's another thing that I like to tell people. And I actually got this from John and Martha King. is that if you're going to plan a fuel stop, you know you're not going to make it nonstop to your destination. Try to plan the stop halfway, not as close as you can to your destination. If you stop halfway there, you'll still have plenty of fuel to get there, but it just plans for a lot more contingencies, and you're just not pushing it toward the end of your fuel reserves.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I'm gonna tell you a story right now that I learned so painfully.
I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear this. You're going to tell me something. I'm going to get angry with you, aren't I?
Yeah, you are.
Okay.
But, all right. But you know, here's why I'm okay with this. I'm okay with it because you're not getting angry with me. You're getting angry with me from like 25 years ago.
Okay.
And so if you want to beat up on that guy, you should, because that guy had no business making decisions like that compared to the guy who's standing in front of you right now.
Well, and you know, that's all of us before we get some experience. You know, they say it's two buckets. You start out with a bucket full of luck and an empty bucket of experience, and you end up, you know, filling your experience bucket and relying less on luck.
True. This one was bad decision making, but I want to get your thoughts on this one and kind of put it out there. So many, many years ago, in a place far, far away, I was flying in a Grumman, in my old Grumman, to Quebec. And that's a no fuel stop trip. It's like 2.5 hours or something. But that aircraft only holds 37 gallons. And you know, hold your anger, because I'm going to say all the real things. Okay. And fuel at that airport in Quebec was out like unfathomably expensive, right? And sold by the liter and all that kind of stuff. And I got some fuel, but looked at everything I needed to get back and just made this judgment call that said, I'm fine, right? And I'm going to be, I can make it. I'm going to be okay. And I had reserves, but not topped and not all the reserves or not whatever it was. And what happened is I took off and weather started moving in, and I was a VFR pilot at the time. And so I had to go around the weather. And as I was going, and then I had a headwind and I was going around the weather, and the trip ended up like, at least an hour got added to this trip. Like, it was painful. And all of a sudden I was in trouble. And trouble meaning worried, really worried. And then the next thing happened, which was I had options. I was flying over Burlington on the way, big airport, good place to go, right? But my customs was set up to arrive at Bedford and within a certain time frame to be at Bedford. And I had been taught in Bedford, Massachusetts, I had been taught and drilled into me for some reason, like, you don't show up where customs is supposed to be, then you are treated as if you are running drugs or doing something else. Like you can't do that. And so I watched my fuel get lower and lower and lower, and got so fixated on getting into Bedford that I remember being on final approach to Bedford and looking at essentially, you know, tanks close to empty or at. And I remember landing, taxiing up, and I remember the guy who fueled up, the lineman that fueled up after my family was no longer, like, they were inside, they were getting, you know, popcorn and stuff. And he came over to me and he said, how many gallons does this plane take? And I said, 37, just like it says on the wing. He said, I put 37 gallons in this plane.
Oh my gosh. Wow. You were so close.
That it never should have happened, but I'd like you to talk about that, because this is, I think, to some people, how these accidents happen. I don't think they happen over, I'm just gonna be reckless, or I'm just gonna, like, it was all the chain. It was a classic chain, right? I did save some money. Yeah. I did make a miscalculation about weather, all these things.
Yeah, and so
I didn't save myself when I could have.
And you raise a very good point. People don't go out there intentionally and say, I'm going to be a misfit or reckless and try to run my tanks as close as I can. I mean, maybe somebody does, but that's generally not what we're talking about. We're talking about the pressures that you experienced right there as well. It starts with the mindset, maximum fuel. And if I have to go further to get a cheaper fuel, I won't do it. If I generally, almost, it's one of my pet peeves when someone says it's cheaper here, so I'm going to go get fuel there or whatever, because I've just seen so many accidents from that last leg going from here to there to get the cheap fuel. And it's happened a lot, and I just don't even put that into the mix. I mean, it's got to be a pretty significant difference in price to make me even think about that, and I probably still wouldn't. So there's that, and there's also the mindset of you have to be not afraid of whatever consequence happens to you because you're still alive. It's not worth dying to get to the right place with customs is going to meet you, or just shy of it. You have to really think that, if I run out of fuel, that's the worst thing that could possibly happen. You might be able to put it down and survive. You might not, but you shouldn't even be planning to go there. If you feel like you're concerned about customs, customs will understand. I mean, it's like it's the whole big emergency thing. It's a tool you keep in your hip pocket that if you have to land somewhere, you might be treated differently. You might be treated as a criminal who just came in the country illegally and whatever, but it will get sorted out. And while it's all being sorted out, you're thankful you're still alive. But you do what you have to do, and things go unplanned and you have to make a land short. You just can't be concerned with customs. That's something you planned for. It didn't work out. Okay, we're going to have to change gears. But right now, safety is fuel. Safety is landing with adequate fuel to go around and having the reserve in my tank. So you can't be concerned with that. You also need to plan for those. You just have to know in your head that these things could happen. I could have to go around weather. My gear might not come down. You know, what if your gear didn't come down on that leg? What would you have done? Knowing you're short on fuel, what would you have done if your gear didn't come down on final approach?
In my case, maybe like something, let's say it's a different kind of aircraft, the gear doesn't come up and now you're supposed to be leaving. You're supposed to be on this plan. You're supposed to be. I hear you.
Yeah, but the contingency is like now I don't have enough for a go around. So
right. That's
I
true.
Don't know how much I have.
Good point.
So I'm talking about the choice of do I go around and try to figure out the gear thing. I want to have that at least 45 minutes to an hour in my hip pocket. Quite honestly, I rarely, like I think we talked about on another show, I rarely use the bottom half of my fuel tank. And not because there's sediment in the bottom part. But because
please
I just
don't
figure that's the just-in-case fuel. If I have a four-hour endurance, I'm going to go 2 hours, stop for fuel every 2 hours. I'm just not.
I totally agree.
And I did have one time, and I'll have a story. Since you told one, I'll tell one. That when I was a student pilot, and I was just signed off to solo flights whenever I wanted to go, and I was 16 years old, and I'm flying our Citabria, and I went where you're only supposed to go 25 miles away, and no more. And I went a lot further to go fly over my girlfriend's tennis match. And I'm coming back, and I'm still pretty farther away than I should be, crossing over LAX. And I remember the sun was back here behind the left wing, and it's a high wing, it's a top rail. But I looked down at my legs, and I could see a shadow kind of going over my legs, just kind of this shadowing. I'm like, what? I'm like, what is this? Where's the sun? And I look back there, and there is fuel just pouring off the top of the wing behind it. And I looked at the Citabria fuel gauges, which I never looked at. This is my fuel gauge. I always figure 10 gallons an hour. If I have 40 gallons, that's 4 hours. It's going to run out of gas at 4 hours. Well, I don't know where I was at on fuel because I don't know how long I'd been leaking. I'd been up for over an hour, and I couldn't tell. I just had no idea where I was at on fuel, right over the top of LAX. And instead of landing there with the 2-mile-long runway just directly beneath me, I plodged away to Santa Monica, which isn't far, but I was worried about getting in trouble. If Dad finds out I did this, I'm going to get in trouble. And he's probably watching right now. I think I told him. But I landed, and it took all but 2 gallons of what that thing holds. And it turns out it's the fuel cap. There's two tabs, one on each, 180 degrees apart, and only one of them was under the lip.
Yep.
So the low pressure on top of the wing was just siphoning, pulling fuel out. And that's from, you can't just turn it to make sure it's tight. You need to make sure it's level, that it's in there properly, that it unscrews and screws tightly after the fueler does it or after you do it. And you can't just take for granted that that happened. You can't take for granted that you got the fuel you asked for. You've got to do the physical check of your fuel. It's just something we have to do.
Yeah. I've had a cap come off also. We're actually not come off, not get put on during fueling. You know, you learn these things like securing something, not coming back to it. And I've done stuff where I was like, during fill-up, I have made a mistake in the past and never do that anymore, ever, where I would, you know, leave the cap off the left, go over to the right, do what I wanted over there, look at where I was, go back over to the left. Whatever I was doing at the time absolutely allowed me to walk away from a cap that was off. And what I found is I saw the stream. As soon as I took off, I looked out and I was making a cloud behind me. And this is what was fascinating to me. The pattern just going up an abbreviated pattern and back down, almost all the fuel of the tank was gone.
Wow. I was going to ask, how fast does it really come out? What kind of airplane was that?
That was in Bonanza, high angle of attack, big fuel opening, almost emptied everything. It was the most, now flip side, that was the most expensive lap in the pattern I have ever done in any aircraft, I will say.
Of a whole tank of gas in one lap?
One wing tank, a complete wing tank of gas in one
pattern. I would argue you could have had a more expensive lesson there and not by money.
True. True.
Wow. Yeah, you got to be careful of that. So I'm always afraid about having the wrong stuff. It's this liquid elixir in there. I know what it should look like. I know what it should smell like. But contaminated fuel just scares the poop out of me.
So that's a big one, right? That's a really, really big one. The best answer to everything is to have someone there when you fuel, period. Mm-hmm. Like you be there when someone's fueling. If you cannot fuel the plane yourself, you need to be there for it. Because you'd be amazed, no matter how many times or how people are trained, it can still happen. And especially if you fly an aircraft with a turbo, especially. And I say that because so many aircraft that are equipped with turbos have that proud label on the end, on the cowl, that says turbo, blah, 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 turbo, blah, blah. I can't tell you how many times I've seen that, right?
Yeah.
Turbo, da, 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 da. And it's like, yes, it looks cool. Yes, that's amazing you have a turbo. Yes, some line person may confuse turbo with turbine. And then I'm telling you that happens. Bad. I've heard stories of it. I work really, really closely with Phillips 66. They have an amazing investment that they make in helping spread the word to stop misfueling and reduce that. Huge, huge effort that they do. And that's one of the things they talk about also. Like the mix up between turbo and turbine, it's crazy.
Well, and you know, I can understand that if they're not pilots, or the fuelers are not pilots a lot of the times. And they're not going to understand. They may not appreciate the difference. They're not educated on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, they say, well, what's going on? Hey, go out there and fuel up that turbo commander.
Right.
And they grab the Jet A truck.
Because if you have a turbo commander, you're not going to say commander. I mean, you're just not going to do it.
Right. And probably neither is anyone in the, in the FBO who's trying to, you know, do that. But so let's talk about a few other things that have to do with fuel. I mean, we want to get to a lot of topics. People have chimed in with all sorts of stuff, which is really cool. Summer's here, right? We've got high temps out. So let's talk a little bit about like things like that can happen both in carbureted aircraft and engines, but especially fuel injected, where you can get vapor lock, fuel pump issues, stuff like that. Talk just a little bit about that, because one of the biggest, you know, I see different types of questions come into me, and a lot of times they are based on the time of year. And I can tell you, this is the time of year that all the hot start questions come in. Right.
That makes sense. I mean, but I've had hot starts when it was pretty cool out. You know, that can happen as well. It's all about timing, you know, if you're hitting that window when the fuel's vaporized or not.
True.
You know, in the spider tubes or whatever they call them. But I think that one thing that when in the summertime you have a lot of, I fly with some people that think, oh, I don't use the carb heat in the summertime. And I know that's more of an engine thing and not a fuel thing, but it's in the carburetor where the fuel is. That fuel evaporating does get pretty cold. And back at idle, when you get that Venturi closed, we got a really big pressure change and the fuel evaporating in that Venturi when it's closed off like that can get very cold. So if you're at all in a climate where there's moisture in the air, even if it's warm out, don't let that fool you. Do what your handbook says as far as using the carburetor heat. I know that another issue is fuel. You know, if you put fuel in your tanks and it's you top it off, it's sitting out in the sun, then you're going to get it coming out the fuel vents and dripping. You know, that's just almost a part of the deal.
Well, yes and no. It is, yes, it's part of the deal, and you can, if fuel is almost always going to be colder than ambient temperature in a hot summer day. It's either pumped from the ground or it's recently pumped from the ground into a truck. It's going to warm in your tanks sitting out in the sun if you leave it there.
And yeah, it's in a smaller tank with less of it around itself.
Yeah, and you can certainly, there's nothing wrong with we're not talking about like, you know, a few gallons of gas. We're talking about like a half a gallon or something. You shouldn't be flying within that range at all. And certainly you can keep yourself from wasting it by knowing your plane, knowing what happens and that it could expand a little bit and staying just a tiny bit shy to protect yourself from doing that. But, you know, the other thing I'd like to point out to everybody is how important the fuel venting is in the summer because of that. And fuel vents aren't just, you know, open tubes. They can be complex systems. I was at an airport recently where a plane at the airport, as I was walking by on a hot summer day, was absolutely like hemorrhaging fuel out of the vent. And this was a low wing plane, and right or wrong, because I'm sure some people would think this is, you know, wrong, don't ever touch anybody's plane, but I knew what was happening. And so I walked over, cracked the cap open and then closed it. And the fuel just stopped. Because the other thing that's built into many, if not most, general aviation aircraft is a siphon break. So what happens is you think the fuel gets up to a certain level and then it needs to escape. And so we build in a vent and that allows the fuel, the overflow to come out. And you think, great, that's great. What can happen is it can then start a siphoning action.
Oh, wow.
And not just do that, but keep going. So what many aircraft have with this is this thing called a siphon break, which is another air, you know, an area of air that comes in with a one-way check valve. So the fuel can't go out that way. Air can only come in, one-way check valve, where as it sees fuel, when you say see, right, like fluid dynamics, as the fuel is going by, you get a suction, just like if you're, you know, blowing through a tube or something, right? And so all this traffic, let's call it, of fuel is going out this line fast. It develops a suction. It opens that one-way check valve, that siphon break, allows air into that, and stops that motion. Well, what happens is these siphon valves are they're just like a flapper, right? It built in this little, you know, cassette, this really small thing, and fuel gets sticky, right? When this happens, you know, you've seen dried fuel that's blue and sticky and all this stuff. And you know, things on all our aircraft are what, 10, 20, 50 years old? You know, like some of this stuff's never been looked at. And so what can happen is that can get stuck and it doesn't want to just flow and pop open. So, you know, these are things to kind of check.
So what did opening the fuel cap do? I'm not clear on how that fixed the problem. I understand that it did.
It performed the exact same function as the suction brake. Think of it this way: if you put a bucket of water up on a table, and you start a siphon, right? You fill a hose with water, you carry it all the way to the bottom, and then you let your thumb off of it, and it starts siphoning all the water out. Oh, right?
So you want to get air in the line to stop the siphon.
All you'd have to do is put a little nick in that hose.
Yeah.
And the siphon would just stop.
Because it would start pulling air in, and that'd be the end of it.
That'd be the end of it. And in this case, okay. that's naturally supposed to happen with the one-way check valve and the siphon brake. But if that sticks, then as soon as you open the fuel cap, you hear like, and then the process just stops.
Well, I didn't know that. That's a new one for me. That's cool.
It can suck a tank dry. It can do a lot.
Well, I'll say if anybody ever sees my airplane doing that, I don't think the Citabria has what you're talking about. But if anybody ever sees that, and you're going to save me some fuel, you feel free to go grab my fuel cap and turn it. I would think that someone would
come out and it's eroded a big hole in the tarmac.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So there are tips. The other thing I want to say is about hot starting, which is certainly you start with following the manual. But
there are as many ways to hot start an airplane as there are pilots.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is there are.
Yeah, the manual is always a good place to start.
Okay, except here's an interesting tip. There's a lot of and serious pilots. Listen up. Have I told you this one?
Yeah, you have. This is amazing.
Okay, people can debate me on this, but I may have actually talked to the source of how this happened. The Cirrus has an IO-550N engine. All the other aircraft that Bonanzas, things like that, they have IO-550s, but they're a different design. They're different type of a fuel system in it and things like that. And my understanding is that you've got a process that I use, that lots of people use for many aircraft that have those Continental engines for hot starts, where you're running fuel through the system. You put the mixture and the throttles pull back, and you're running fuel through to try to cool things, right? Run cold fuel through before you crack it and let it actually pressurize the system. That's the goal. And what you're doing is you're sending fuel out to the fuel manifold and back, because it's got a return. And so it gets there, it reaches a dead end. Oh, it can't do anything right now. And then it goes right back out through the relief and returns back to the fuel pump. And
that's what it should do.
Right. And that's what it should do. And that cool and the act of doing that will cool those lines. It won't cool the lines on top of the engine. It won't cool your fuel flow divider. It won't cool your injectors and things like that. But it'll cool part of your system and make it a little easier to hot start in some cases. Well, when the Cirrus came out with the N version of that engine, somewhere along the line, someone just went and took the exact same hot start procedure that was certified, that was approved by the FAA for the IO-550 B and C and all the other ones, and just said, oh, here's the procedure. This is how you do it, period. Well, it turns out that engine doesn't have a return. There is no fuel return on an IO-550N. You can run it all day long directly, and it will have no way of cooling, flowing, or returning. And it's in a ton of POHs.
And that's in the Cirrus.
Nothing. Yeah. So, file the POH, but also listen to the community and what works. And like you said, there's as many techniques as pilots. So learn from that.
Yeah. That's actually interesting that you wouldn't think. We like to have faith in our flight manuals, that our POHs, that what went into it should have some integrity. So it's surprising to hear that, but I guess it shouldn't be as well. I know that another thing that I've done too, and also in Bonanzas, if you can open the cowl like on a Bonanza when you're parked for lunch on a hot day, open the cowling, point it into the wind. So
Absolutely.
The wind is coming. Even if you can only open the fuel access, the oil access door, you're going to let some air flow through there. There are a lot of techniques you can do to try to avoid that to begin with. And there's the tried and true, always just flood the engine and then do a flood start.
The only thing I will say about that cowl opening thing is please be careful, because I've seen so
many people where it's a windy day, and they sort of do that, and then like some wind gust, you know, it's like a door, right? You're gonna damage your aircraft. So you know, just be careful. Hey, I have to say, my good friend, the astronaut, amazing human being on every single level, Jay Apt, just chimed in with a question, so he gets a shout out on this, and he has said that he's heard that you can blow 10 psi or very low pressure and nothing above that air into a vent to periodically check an anti-siphon valve or clear it. And the answer is to that, my response to that is like kind of yes and no. Yes, you should always be very, very careful with blowing anything into that. You can do a little bit of that, but it's so remarkably easy to open the access panel that goes to where that little valve is and literally open it up and clean it. Like it's that's something that, so if you're blowing stuff through, you will sort of help, like if it's already stuck, pop it off, but it doesn't mean it won't get re-adhered. And so really like just some routine maintenance, or like if you have a system like this in your aircraft, I'd say, you know, if it's never been done on your aircraft or you don't see it in the logbooks, next annual inspection, this is literally going to be a 15-minute job. Like, ask, pay for it, right? 15 minutes a wing, 30 minutes. Pay for it. Have it done. Feel better. And they'll get in there, clean off the goo. You're good to go.
How does a pilot who's not a mechanic even know about that? I would never have known to ask a mechanic to do that.
Really?
Honestly,
only from cockpit to cowl.
You got to watch cockpit to cowl for these things, I guess. Otherwise, you would never know. That's funny. Yeah. I know that, you know, operationally speaking as well, when you're in the summertime hot temperatures, your air is less dense, and you've got the same amount of fuel you're throwing in there, because these engines are not like automobile engines with the electronic fuel ignition computers that compensate for density. So you got to lean before takeoff. And I think that's just one other thing that I like to talk about in the hot temp times, is if you are at a high density altitude. Now, the books, a lot of the manuals will just say if you're at an airport above 3,000 feet, you should lean before takeoff. Well, what 3,000 feet? Pressure altitude, density altitude, indicated altitude, true altitude? What are we talking here? And it should say density altitude. That's all the engine knows about, is the density of the air that's coming into it. So if you do a density altitude calculation, it's above 3,000 feet or whatever your POH says, altitude you should lean for takeoff, then that's when you should do a full power run-up and lean for the best RPM or best, however your book says to do it. Some airplanes are different, so be sure you know how to do it in your airplane. But you are not going to get maximum takeoff power if you're way too rich because the air is too dense, or is too thin. And your mixture is way too rich. So just something to be aware of. It's not just the elevation of the airport. It's the density altitude. Use that for determining whether or not you're going to lean for best power for takeoff.
Yeah. And by the way, a quick correction. I said earlier, I believe like 10 PSI. We're talking very, very small. You only need like one PSI, half a PSI.
That's how I clean out the pitot
tube. You want to be so, so careful about any kind of pressurization with a fuel thing that you sort of just want to avoid it, I guess is the message. The other thing I want to point out, though, is you mentioned fuel caps too, right? So fuel caps need maintenance. Fuel caps have O-rings and gaskets and all sorts of things that go on there that are really important. And as an owner, you can really do this, and you're talking $5 in parts. Like, you know, do that. And when you do it, consider using something like Fuel Lube. If you haven't heard of that, check it out. It is, on one hand, it's a really cool thing to have because
did you say Fuel Lube?
I did. Fuel Lube.
Never heard of Fuel Lube.
Yeah, I should have grabbed it. It's like on a bench behind me here. Yes.
With all your other lubes?
Thanks. It is, on one hand, it's a miracle thing, right? Because it does not dissolve in fuel. It keeps those O-rings sealing and in good shape and everything else. On the other hand, I'll warn you in advance, it is just the worst stuff in the world because it does not dissolve in fuel.
Oh yeah, how do you
it does it not off? Come off easily.
That's what I use to get hard to get off stuff is avgas.
Yeah. Well, so get some fuel lube. If I could run away right now, I'd go and I'd grab it and I'd hold it up and I'd say, get this. You will get one tube that will keep you and then your children and then your grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and they will all talk about you and how you were the person that got the fuel lube for generations of your family because you used the tiniest dab.
So is this something that's on a normal part of an annual inspection to look at the fuel caps and the rubber gaskets or the whatever?
It should be, but I'm not going to lie. Like, I mean, does it always get done? No. Like,
But I think you as a pilot are looking at it regularly because you're always taking the fuel cap off. So that should be part of our inspection. If it seems like it's getting more like hard plastic than it is rubber, it's probably time.
My message is always that don't forget, you as the pilot are responsible for the airworthiness of the aircraft. This is your investment. This is your life. This is your family. Therefore, everything that you can do, you should at least be inspecting. Even if you don't feel qualified to do the work, you should know about it. You should inspect it. You should keep an eye on it. If you're not willing to be invested enough to know how to see if something does need work, then, you know, how are you taking the rest of your flying?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the backups, and this is no joke, why I tell people they should clean their own airplanes. They should wipe them down after every flight. You are going to become familiar with every scratch, every dent, every little buckle in the airplane or every little curve in the metal to know what's normal and what's not. So the more you pre-flight it, the more time you spend looking at your airplane thoroughly, the more you're going to know when something is different when it changes. And I think that's a very important part of regularity and making a habit out of looking thoroughly at your airplane.
Yeah. So I do really like what you said earlier also about that idea about thinking of everything in terms of altitude, thinking about that leaning, thinking about the other stuff. And it goes both ways, meaning you have to think about leaning, but also you really should be paying attention whether or not it's a carbureted aircraft or whether it's a fuel-injected aircraft to what your fuel flow is to make sure you have enough cooling fuel flow as well for the day. It's a delicate balance, but you have to make sure your aircraft's set up for it properly to make sure that you're addressing that. If you have a fuel-injected engine, they require fuel setups with calibrated gauges. And if you're not doing that, then you're potentially not getting the cooling that you need from the fuel in the engine at a critical time, which can result in detonation, can result in other problems with the engine and overheating and cylinder damage. Just as important as perhaps leaning a little bit if your density altitude tells you that you need to do that. And with carbureted engines, it can be, if people are having heat issues, high CHTs and things like that, it can also be that there's an issue with the jetting or there's an issue with getting full rich or something like that on it. And, you know, so look at it no matter what.
Yeah, and don't ignore the signs when you see something different than it normally is. You want to try to have a bias toward continuing and talking yourself into taking the flight and that, oh, there must be a reason that you can explain this away and then go flying. If it's abnormal, don't do it. A lot of airplane problems, emergencies that have come from malfunctions, they manifested themselves in some way in an indication that the pilot ignored. You know, just if you have a small growth on your skin, go see a dermatologist. If you have a small little hiccup in your engine after you start it, look into it, find out why. There's a reason for it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, too many people kind of ignore things that come out of the norm. And I'll also add something else to that, which is when you mess with one part of the system, you need to follow the thread through to the entire system. And what I mean by that is I've known people, for example, that add power flow exhaust to their aircraft, right? Great system. Nothing bad to say about that system. But it affects everything. If you are going to breathe easier on the engine, you're going to produce more heat, you're going to be trying to take in more air, you're creating more energy, that's when you need to start thinking about, how's my carburetor? Does that have to change? Do I need to put a different fuel jet in that's legal, that's part of the design of this aircraft to make sure
so that, because I've had people add things and then have heat issues afterwards. I've had people go in and repair one part of a fuel injection system or change a carburetor and not go through everything else that that could mean in terms of changes and following up. So, you know, fuel is a system, and I think it's really important to kind of follow the thread whenever you can.
Yeah, that's good advice. On the, you know, whole matter of fueling, also, if you're leaning to have best power and you don't have any, and your performance requires that you cannot eke it in a little bit more for engine cooling, you're probably planning too close to your limit. In other words, don't go right up to the edge of the performance you need so that you have to have the leanest mixture possible, you know, the best power possible, but you're going to overheat your engine. Now you're torn between, do I overheat my engine or do I hit the trees? If you get to that kind of situation where it's that tight, you've already screwed up. You've gotten to a place you shouldn't be.
Yeah. No question. Couple other things having to do with fuel. I wrote an article in AOPA that I would encourage people to take a peek at, just because I think it hits this topic. We're at a very unique time in history where our fuel system is going to change. And I'm not trying to get into the politics of it or right or wrong or any of that stuff. But what we know at this point is that the fuels that have either passed or are likely to pass and become unleaded fuels and available to us, we know that they stress our mechanical systems in ways that the oldest 100 low lead didn't. And then even the 100 low lead has changed its formulation. And what I mean by that is they're fine. They're passing tests. They're fine for like brand new fuel bladders, brand new fuel sealants, good hoses, good whatever. But in so many of our aircraft, these things are weak or failing already, right? You have tiny pinhole leaks in
You're saying because of lead or because of the new fuel?
It's because of the replacement of the lead that they're going to higher aromatics, benzenes and different things like that, toluene, different aromatics that they're experimenting with that will help the octane without using lead.
I just want to confirm I'm hearing you right. So the new chemicals are having an effect, a negative impact on older parts. Is that right?
I want to be very careful about saying it. I want to say the way I want to make it clear is they are more aggressive and a healthy component can handle it.
Okay.
But it is not the same level of aggressiveness as 100 low lead. And therefore, it's like having a little tiny pinhole crack in the dike, and this is going to push through that.
I got
Whereas you. The other stuff was going to—it was always going to fail, right? You had the leak.
Yeah.
If I were to sit there and look at the average GA airport with 30, 40, 50-year-old airplanes on the ramp, right? I would be willing to put money down that more than half of them have some tiny weakness in their fuel system that we just don't know about. There's because it evaporates. There's a tiny pinhole starting at a weld in a tank somewhere that's aluminum. There's a tiny leak happening at a nipple in a fuel bladder somewhere. There's a little bit of sealant that's starting to lift in a Mooney tank.
And, well, who hasn't seen a little bit of blue staining underneath a Cessna wing?
So, right.
But there's no puddle on the ground. I actually had an instructor tell me it's okay because there's no puddle on the ground. It's obviously it's just seeping so slowly and evaporating. And I'm like, that's not okay, is it?
And is it? It is okay, believe it or not.
Okay.
The FAA has guidelines. They actually tell you. AC 4313 will tell you what a leak, a seep, a stain, a running leak. It has definitions and says, this is okay. This needs to be washed. Watched. This absolutely is not airworthy. Yeah, there actually are guidelines. It's actually not. Now, certainly
it
depends.
What if it smells inside like avgas? In the cabin, you smell avgas. Is that okay?
But that's totally different, right? Yes. In those guidelines,
right.
It says, in the cabin, zero.
Okay, good, because I refused to fly a Cessna that smelled like avgas inside the cabin. And I thought, I don't know where it is. We can't find where it's coming from. But I can tell you, my gut tells me, and I got a gut, it's smart, that I should not be flying an airplane when I smell fuel inside the cabin.
Right.
And the owner was just pissed because I refused to fly with him, because I'm flying it all the time like this. I said, well, then that proves nothing could possibly go wrong. No.
Yeah, correlation and causation. Right. Yeah.
Right.
You know, again, there are guidelines. Anyone can look them up. This is a free publication, 4313, all these guidelines. There are in maintenance manuals that also tell you for your aircraft what the guidelines are for fuel leaks. So, yes, it can't be in the cabin, but there's all sorts of different things that go there. My point is, I'll bet a lot of people out there who think they have zero leaks probably have some tiny little leak. And it just evaporates, yeah. And you wouldn't know unless you took everything apart and we're going to work on the tank. And you're like, oh, look at that. It's actually starting to fail over here. That is going to become a problem. And so the best way, the best thing we can do is get ahead of it. And the way we get ahead of it is to start thinking about it the way that you start thinking about overhauling your engine. You're saving for it. You're starting to plan on different things. Start looking at it and saying, like, you know, whether I need it or not, I'm going to replace that all the fuel lines that are flexible, that are not hard lines in my aircraft. I'm going to do that next year. I'm going to replace my fuel bladder 2 years from now on the left, and two years after that on the right. Like, no matter what, just start getting ahead of it. I just don't want to see everyone hit so hard with a big surprise.
That's fair. I think it's good advice. I initially, you know, poo-pooed the whole idea of a new fuel because I thought, why are we trying to reinvent the wheel? We got a good thing here. It's good and it works. Until I do, and I learned what lead does. And that kind of really did open my eyes. I had no idea. And I didn't have any idea how much I'm exposed to it every time I take a whiff of avgas to make sure it's avgas.
You know? That's not healthy, man. I mean, no. It's hard to argue against that. There's a if anyone watches like a bunch of YouTube and stuff, there's a guy Veritasium, who's a wonderful you know, science guy who does a history of lead, and you don't have to be wherever you want to be on the political spectrum of it or ideas of it. You might want to watch it. It really tells you what kind of has happened to society. It doesn't mean that that's what GA is doing. I do think that our impact is different, but the impact to your town that's fighting against your airport is one thing. You can debate if we're really affecting that or not. The impact to you by spilling it all over your hand over and over again when you sample fuel instead of taking the time to make sure it doesn't happen.
Yeah, this is how I always see if it's full or not. I mean, every time I fly.
That's why you got the, what, only four fingers on that hand?
Yeah. But that, you know, I taught for so many years, if you got to feel it to know it's there. If you don't feel it, it's the level's too low. And so here I am telling people to.
You never heard of a dipstick? Like,
what'd you call me? <I'm> breaking up. No, that's what my dad taught me. It's the old school, darn it. And we liked it. But I didn't know how much harm I was doing. That's bad.
Yeah. As we do get tight on time, I want to make sure I hit a few other things that I just had in notes here. The other one is primers. A lot of people got, you know, prime the engine. That is something you should be taking apart, cleaning, changing the O-rings, putting fuel lube on it. Another push for fuel lube. Someone else chimed in with a great thing, which is fuel lube is great for, like, sticking to the end of a screwdriver or the end of a wrench or the end of whatever. If you want to hold a nut or hold something, the stuff is sticky as you can imagine. So, yeah, it's got all sorts of uses other than cleaning up.
That's funny. Well, yeah, the primer, I once had a student that they pulled it out. So I see sometimes I see people misuse the primer. They don't understand what's happening. They just go like as fast as they can. I'm like, you're not even giving a chance to suction any fuel into the primer. And I said, wait till the thing is quiet. Wait till it's done pulling fuel into it, then push it in. And he says, if I do that, I can't push it in. So he's like 2 feet. He's got his foot up on the, and he's trying to push the primer in with his foot. It's that tight after it pulled the fuel in. I said, you need maintenance. there's something wrong with that, right? I mean,
yeah,
primers should be like,
yeah,
shouldn't be that.
They're easy to work on. You barely need a tool.
Yeah, like, and don't just look. Don't just look and make sure the pin is not lined up in the hole. I tell people, pull on the primer. If it doesn't come out, then it's locked. Just like to tell you if your door is closed, push on the door. That's how you tell if it's latched.
You know, there's another thing too about that's a benefit of paying some, giving your primer system some love, and that is that if they're not sealing properly in the way that allows you to suction the fuel and press the fuel in, if that system's not working, it's also letting air by. And that means that you can be running more lean in the cylinders that have the primer lines running to them, because they're going to suck air through there. And that's like having an induction leak. It is an induction leak. It's just coming through your primer.
Interesting. Is the primer upstream or downstream of the mixture cutoff?
It goes straight to the cylinder. So
if you have the mixture back to full lean or cutoff, you can still prime the engine?
Well, you can't if it is. Yes, you can still prime the engine with the mixture off. Correct.
This is something I'd wondered.
You know what? I want to be careful about saying that absolutely, because in some aircraft, maybe it's
different done airplanes. Differently
than that. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if you are not sealed in that, it's going to be able to suck fuel and keep motoring when you are sitting there going, why is this not stopping? Depending on the design of the aircraft.
It makes sense. I wish I could have pulled up a diagram, the fuel schematic of my airplane, because there's some things about it I don't understand, and I should have pulled it up and said, hey, can I ask you this on the show? And we'll have to save that for another time. But I'd like to take some schematics of some systems and maybe ask you, because I can look at it from a pilot's perspective and say, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know about it, and I want to ask you about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, there is something else that I do want to talk about there that we've seen. And you can go online and look it up. And that is you do need to look carefully at these new fuels that are coming out, because we have seen a lot of reports of paint damage. And, you know, our good friend, yours and mine, Juan Brown at Blanco Lirio, he did a YouTube short on a Cirrus that he was working on. And I'd say go check out that YouTube short on the Blanco Lirio channel, and you can kind of see that side of things. And there's some concerns about that too. And the idea there is, if you wipe it off, if you wipe fuel off, it should be fine. But if it stays on, it can cause paint damage more than 100 low lead could. And, my answer to that, my concern about that is, who's to say we're around when that's happening, right? To wipe it off.
How do you know?
Right?
What about fabric airplanes?
Problem with that. Yeah.
What about fabric aircraft?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. But again, I think we are talking about the possibility, if this really happens and we all go to, these unleaded fuels, of more aggressive fuel in every way you can think.
And, are we on a timeline with that? Is there a time set for when this has to happen?
Not anymore that I'm aware of. Not anymore. But there's another side to this, which has nothing to do with environmental safety or health or any of that. And the other side of it is, remember that the rest of the world has walked away from lead. And so there is one company in one plant that is supplying all of the lead that we happen to use in 100 low lead. There's other places like China and India, I believe, that there is some lead produced. But what we use, what's in your tank in 100 low lead in this country, comes from one place at, I think it's Lyondell or I forget what the name. Anyway, one place. And man, think about that from just a risk of business, a risk of our livelihood. In loving to fly.
Yeah.
And if that plant burned to the ground just because of an accident or something, what would do? Like, I'm a little concerned about that.
I never knew that. That's crazy. That's risky. Yeah. Wow.
Just not a place that we necessarily want to be. Right. Well, we're approaching
the top of the hour, I do want to make sure I get one thing out there real, real clear, because we're approaching AirVenture. We're not going to have a show between now, you know, when we come back, AirVenture's over in Oshkosh. So I want to make sure, I hope a lot of people who watch the show will be at AirVenture, and I would love to meet you guys out there. I would love it so much, and I'm saying I because I've been beating up Brian, and I think he won't be there with me, or he may surprise me, but I'm not trying to. I'm being careful about this. It's all coming from a place of love, man.
I know it is, and I just pulled the trigger on not going this year, but I do reserve the right to change my mind and show up for a day or two as a surprise if I can. But I just got myself too bogged down.
I got a place for you. I got everything. Oh my God! If you make that happen, you come. But for all of you out there, I will be there every day of the show, walking the grounds all over the place. Look for the Social Flight Partner banners. It's going to be a flag. It's a big teardrop flag at every one of the folks here on this sign. At everyone here, I'm just going to be rotating around between all of these guys. And here's what I did. I went to all of them and basically said, hey, what can you give our viewers? What can we do for everybody? And so it starts with, I'll be there with a whole bunch of swag from Social Flight. We'll be giving away all sorts of little fun things and whatever. Then we've got our Fly to Win Challenge. That's, get the Social Flight mobile app, totally free. Get the Fly to Win Challenge. Check in at just one airport and you're entered into win. Go to a bunch of airports, do a bunch of flying, and you'll get extra entries. But even once, you're entered into win. Got Aspen. We're going to be giving away an E5 electronic flight instrument on August 1st. Okay? So that's huge. Think about how much money. We're going to give that away. Okay? You have to own an aircraft. That's about the only thing. So we're giving away that. We've got Michelin. And Michelin said, find us someone to give a set of brand new Pilot tires to. They're top of the line tires. And so here's the deal. Find me. And send an email. You have to be at the show. info@socialflight.com and tell me your tire story. Any tire story. Some cool tire story. You'll be entered into win. We're going to pick someone and someone's going to get a whole set of tires. We got Philip 66 said, hey, give away some cases of oil. So track me down. I want to give tons of stuff away. I want to help everyone. I am so thrilled that all of you join us, Brian and I, help us with Social Flight. We're really just trying to sincerely support general aviation and anything we can do to give back. We're here for it. So please track me down. I hope you win.
I will track you down if I'm there because I want to get something free too.
Yes. Oh, and Avemco. Mention Social Flight to Avemco. You get 5% off. So they chimed in too. Anyway, we've reached.
I will, however. I'm not going to make it to Oshkosh, although I might show up and surprise you. I'm just not committing to it. But I will, however, be on the Shift Show Thursday night, two nights from tonight.
And so will I. Are you kidding me? Awesome. The Shift. So what are you going to be talking about Thursday night? And by the way, tell people where to go also to register.
Yeah, it's The Shift Show. No registration required at all. Just go to theshiftshow.tv and just go there at the right time and click on the link to start watching. You can watch all the archived episodes there too. But we're going to be actually Thursday night, two nights from now, will be twice the shift as normal because I'm going to have Dad on board, and he and I are going to be talking about the Kogan Air accident and what we have learned from that, and we're basically going to get into stalls and spins and aircraft control.
Okay, so that's the Kogan Air?
Yeah, the Kogan Air accident, which sadly until recently had been the last deadly U.S. air carrier accident back in 2009. And that was the last one in a long time. Yeah. So we've been doing pretty good, but that was a very landmark setting accident that new rules were created from FAR rest rules to the ATP training rule to the hiring requirements. A lot of things changed as a result of that accident.
Wow. Well, I'll be on, and I'm sure it'll be in a massive crowd as always. So for all of you who typed in so many amazing questions, we're going to read them, and maybe we'll try to tackle some of them at the beginning of our next show. We're actually
we do need to have just a straight Q&A show, because we can't get all these. We really need to start just attacking some of these.
Yes. Maybe we'll do that for a good holiday show. Maybe we'll have like a holiday show where we just do Q&A.
Yeah, that would be fun.
There's no way we're going to answer all the questions anyway. So it's still just, you know,
well, drinking. We got a mission.
Yes, we do. Oh, next thing. So we've got everybody. You've got the Shift Show on Thursday. Then Tuesday, July 15th. Don't miss this one. SocialFlightLive.com. Just go SocialFlightLive.com. Astronaut Hoot Gibson, test pilot.
Really, really?
Oh my goodness, is he an amazing human being? Will be joining us Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, same time as this show, same day as this show. Next Tuesday, Hoot Gibson. Oh, you don't want to miss that.
That's going to be cool. That's awesome.
And then we're back Tuesday, August 12th, my friend.
That'll be a fun one. It'll go like that, but we'll be there in another month.
You got it. All right. Well, thank you, Brian, for such a I look forward to it. This is the highlight of my last week. No question.
Well, I look forward to it too, so much so that even when I'm at work, as you can see, I'm not in my normal digs. I'm going to make sure I attend.
You got it. Yeah. All right. Well, to all of you, thank you for everything that you do to support General Aviation, for joining us here tonight. You will get Wings credit. That'll be taken care of after the show and tomorrow. It takes a little bit of time for that, but we really, really appreciate it. And from me, from Jeff Salmon and Social Flight, I just want to say thank you so much and blue skies.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Good night, everyone.